Following are comments on Shakespeare's Henry V, Act 4, Chorus through and including Scene 1. A separate commentary will cover Act 4, Scenes 2 through 8. Mean and gentle all, behold as may unworthiness define, a little touch of Harry in the night. The chorus describes the eager French and anxious English armies before battle. During the night, Henry walks among his men and bucks up their spirits. The chorus wishes the stage could do justice to so great an event as Agincourt. The chorus speaker for Act 4 describes the evening's calm before the storm, with the French awaiting their victory and the diminished, anxious English forces hanging on until morning comes. He previews the English King Henry's nighttime walk through his encampment to give heart to his soldiers by bestowing upon them, quote-unquote, a little touch of Harry in the night. Chorus 4, line 47. As for the audience, our task, as usual, consists in, quote-unquote, minding true things by what their mockeries be. Chorus 4, line 53. If the cause be not good, the king himself hath a heavy reckoning to make. Disguised, Henry walks through his camp before battle and meets Pistol, hears Fluellen and Gower's back and forth, and argues with the common soldier Michael Williams. Alone, King Henry reflects on the burdens of his office. In Act 4, Scene 1, the king speaks to Erpingham about setting an example, saying, quote-unquote, 'Tis good for men to love their present pains upon example. Act 4, Scene 1, lines 18 through 19. He understands the mass psychology of battle, the importance of exemplary conduct. Montaigne suggests in his essay of the inconstancy of our actions, as translated by John Florio, that our virtues fluctuate with circumstance and desire. Yesterday's virtuous woman is shameless today, and the courageous man of a recent battle is just as likely to turn and run next time. When it comes to our thoughts, Montaigne suggests, quote-unquote, our ordinary manner is to follow the inclination of our appetite this way and that way. And, he continues, quote-unquote, all is but changing, motion and inconstancy. It isn't known precisely when Shakespeare read Montaigne's essays, but King Henry's insistence on the importance of his personal presence among the troops seems to flow from a similar understanding. As Harry Leroy, Henry goes on a walking tour and meets first with Pistol, who comically mistakes Leroy for a Cornish surname and praises the king but threatens Fluellen, saying, quote-unquote, tell him I'll knock his leek about his pate upon St. Davy's Day. Act 4, Scene 1, lines 54 through 55. There is irony in the flourishing of such clan-based hatreds, even as the English army confronts superior French forces. Meanwhile, Fluellen is busy lecturing Gower on not being foolish enough to let the opponent hear his conversation. Quote unquote, if the enemy is an ass and a fool and a prating coxcomb, is it meet, think you, that we should also, look you, be an ass and a fool and a prating coxcomb? Act 4, Scene 1, lines 75 through 77. Gower agrees to pipe down. Some actors choose to play this episode with Fluellen practically shouting his warnings to Gower, which intensifies its comic potential. Fluellen also airs his opinion, again, that there must be firm order, a respect for the rules in war, and he calls to witness no lesser light than the Roman general and triumvir Pompey the Great. It's fine to voice this insistence, but in practice, such idealism quickly gives way to horrifying scenes of death and destruction. Unfortunately, the war scenes of Voltaire's Candide sometimes read more like nonfiction than anything that belongs in a novella. In disguise as Harry Leroy, King Henry meets the common soldier Michael Williams, who speaks with a mix of fear, distrust, and anger. But first, to the more amenable soldier Bates, Henry argues that nobody should rehearse their fears and doubts in front of the king, saying, quote unquote, "I think the king is but a man, as I am." Act 4, Scene 1, Line 98. The point is that a ruler is as susceptible to despair and paralysis as the ordinary soldier or mid-level commander. All are linked in a chain of responsibility for one another's welfare. The king's groundedness and view of the big picture in morals and politics show in his exchange with Williams, a humble but astonishingly frank subject who tells him, quote unquote, "If the cause be not good, the king himself hath a heavy reckoning to make when all those legs and arms and heads chopped off in a battle shall join together at the latter day." Act 4, Scene 1, Lines 125 through 128. There is something redolent of menace in Williams's honest summation. Quote unquote, "Now, if these men do not die well, it will be a black matter for the king that led them to it." Act 4, Scene 1, Lines 133 through 134. Against this charge, Henry sums up his argument with the thought, quote unquote, "Every subject's duty is the king's, but every subject's soul is his own." Act 4, Scene 1, Lines 161 through 162. Both parties speak of end things of Christian eschatology. They talk of mortality and eternal judgment following the resurrection of the dead. In that context, the soul is more than the body, so King Henry can send his subjects to fight in a foreign war without being responsible for their fate, whether physical or spiritual. The state of his men's souls at death is something only they can answer for. A philosophical materialist will surely have issues with the king's argument and will most likely call it out as evasive. Williams's last judgment theological framework, however, leaves him with little to say by way of a comeback. It seems that King Henry V can relate to his subjects at something like their own level, yet he maintains the perspective of a man operating on a higher plane of experience and understanding. When Harry LeRoy and Bates address the subject of whether the king would agree to be ransomed, Williams steps in heavily with a keen sense of the multi-tiered notion of justice and human value that seems to him to be at work. He insists that any talk of refusing ransom is only, quote unquote, "to make us fight cheerfully, but when our throats are cut, he may be ransomed, and we never the wiser." Act 4, Scene 1, Lines 175 through 177. Williams and Henry take each other's remaining words ill, and a quarrel is struck up between them to be finished later. The two men exchange gloves as a pledge. Act 4, Scene 1, Lines 189 through 196, inclusive. Alone at last, King Henry meditates on his burdens as monarch. He asks of the ceremony, quote unquote, "that makes a king, quote unquote, art thou aught else but place, degree, and form, creating awe and fear in other men?" Act 4, Scene 1, Lines 223 through 224 and 229. See Lines 207 through 261 inclusive. The king is considered responsible for everyone, so only peasants sleep well. The gap between the person and the symbol is huge, potentially infinite. Perhaps, then, monarchy is a projection of the subject's own desires, an investment in something symbolic, something larger than themselves on which the king in his material person is then expected to make good. There is a penitential structure to Henry's kingship. Much of what he does here in France seems meant to wash the blood from his father's hands, some of which attaints him as well. He prays to the quote-unquote God of battles earnestly, quote-unquote, "Oh, not today, think not upon the fault my father made in compassing the crown." Act 4, Scene 1, Lines 270 through 271. The irony of starting an expiatory war, if that is what it is in part, in which thousands of innocents and combatants are bound to be killed, may or may not fully occur to King Henry. Though his concluding statement, quote unquote, "All that I can do is nothing worth, since that my penitence comes after all, imploring pardon," is suggestive. Act 4, Scene 1, lines 280 through 282. All in all, Henry's soliloquy indicates intense awareness that the life of kings is not their own. They are actors on a grand stage, and all eyes behold them. Few are the moments when they can, as King Henry V does now, turn inward and converse with what they find there. To appreciate fully the maturity of this young king as Shakespeare casts him on the eve of Agincourt 1415, we must remind ourselves of the road Henry has traveled to get to this point. In Henry IV Part 1, back when he was still the prodigal son Prince Hal, and, as such, a thorn in his father's side, Henry had spent much of his time with hard-drinking rascals like the Jolly Knight and sometime highway robber Sir John Falstaff and his friends, some of whom we meet in Henry V. Henry's father, the king, found that such brazen behavior violated his own public relations principle that a great prince is more prized by making himself scarce than by mingling with low company. That failure to appreciate the dignity of his office is among the chiefest of the faults in Richard II that Henry Bolingbroke, soon to be Henry IV, used with ruthless effectiveness against his predecessor, who, Bolingbroke says in Act 3, Scene 2, quote unquote, "mingled his royalty with capering fools." Even so, a species of mingling was Prince Hal's way of getting to know his subjects, the better to govern them. So, in Henry IV Part 1, the prince is busy trying out various roles, learning how the various subjects in his future kingdom think and live. In Act 1, Scene 2 of Henry IV Part 1, Hal himself describes his antics in providential terms. Quote unquote, "My reformation, glittering o'er my fault, shall show more goodly and attract more eyes than that which hath no foil to set it off," and pledges to himself that his reformation will amount to, quote unquote, "redeeming time when men think least I will." Kingly virtue has always been Henry's redemptive goal, whatever capers he may have committed on his way to the throne. That may or may not have been true of the real Henry, but it seems true of Shakespeare's character, who goes from Hal to the ultimate warrior king, Henry V, October 1415's victor at Agincourt against an imposing French army. All of the above makes Henry V, Act 4, Scene 1, the successful culmination of a long process. King Henry's method has always been that of an actor, a grand one who has workshopped his way to present glory, interacting with all manner of citizens from the common tavern to battlefields full of fiery nobility. Henry V's self is not a romantic, unique, nameless, intimate self. It is rather the product of trying out many different stations and styles on his way to appreciating his one true office, a medieval relational term for defining a person by his or her role in life, entailing as it does certain responsibilities within the political and social order. A king must understand, in Shakespeare's terms, that he plays a role on the stage of life. That means taking on grave burdens and enduring potentially harsh consequences. But it's no less a role than if the person were simply strutting across the theatrical boards. Henry's playful past has also imbued him with the medieval and Renaissance truth, as explored by Ernst Kantorowicz in his study, The King's Two Bodies, that the king has not one body, but two, a natural body that desires, breathes, and dies, and a body political or civil, whose boundaries go beyond the personal and the physical. The king is, in part, a walking set of duties, and this transpersonal aspect of him is what promises political continuity, as well as, to borrow Thomas More's term in Utopia, the majesty, quote-unquote, that comes with respect for whatever is larger than material affairs and ordinary humanity. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Wednesday, November 5th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.